You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt, and we're here in the studio today talking to Lynn Sharon Schwartz, whose book Leaving Brooklyn has been published by Houghton Mifflin. Also with us is Koki Iwamoto, the owner of the well-beloved Los Angeles bookstore Chatterton's, and we'll be talking with him about independent bookstore owning in a city like Los Angeles. Lynn Sharon Schwartz is the author of 6 books. Probably the most well-known of them is the very brilliant Disturbances in the Field, a book which I at first pushed from me, feeling too naturalistic. But then as I became engrossed in its dailiness and in its passions, I found myself reading it with an attention that I just hadn't given any other book I felt before. I felt it opened a new area of reading for me, a reading that was more sympathetic to people than to language or to form. In Leaving Brooklyn, Lynn Sharon Schwartz's new book, there's a kind of writing in which form very much matches style and content. How long did this take you to write? This is a novella, really.
Yes, it's a very short novel or novella. It was, I hesitate to say this, but it was very easy to write. It wrote itself once I began. It took me a year. It was from one August to another, I think 1987 to 88. And it was an easy book. Most writers don't ever admit that, but this was.
When you started it, did you know what its thematic would be?
Not at all. In fact, I started it in a kind of despair. I was trying to write a different book entirely. I decided it was time to write a significant book, I say that with quotation marks, and it was going to be about Houston, Texas, where I had just spent a few awful months. And it was going to involve air conditioning and the Sun Belt and Oliver North and many other large issues. And I just couldn't do it. It was boring, and it wasn't my material. And out of a kind of desperation, I thought, just to get myself writing again and moving, I'll write about something that's very familiar. I'll write about my eye, because I have a lazy eye, the way the character in the book does. And I know about it, and it was just childhood memories are easy to write about. So I started, and I had an essay of 20 pages, and then I had an essay of 40 pages. And I was interested in writing an essay, but I thought I'll keep away from fiction. And then I got very caught up in the material, and I realized I was making things up. As fiction writers find this irresistible, they start making up as soon as they get going. And before I knew it, I realized this is the novel. It's not going to be about Houston and air conditioning. But it's the metaphor in the other one was air conditioning, as a sealed in kind of thing. And here it became vision and an outward looking. And I didn't know what it was going to be about. I knew that there would have to be some kind of awakening, some kind of coming to knowledge, some kind of escape. And then the sexual avenue suggested itself because it's so obvious for an adolescent. And little by little, things accreted. And then I went back when it was done. It was shorter. And I opened it up sort of like an accordion and put things in.
Leaving Brooklyn is about double vision in several senses. The vision of the grown-up woman looking back on the adolescent that she was, but also the double vision of the adolescent who, through one eye, sees a clearly constructed world that all of us are in, and with her other lazy eye, what she comes to call her bad eye, she sees the vision of essentially the bad Audrey, almost as if the bad side of the self had been given manifest form.
Yes, the bad in the sense of the unconventional, the rebellious, not the wicked, but the bad, the hidden, and then bad in the sense of naughty. So it's bad in every sense. It starts out meaning bad. The eye is weak. It doesn't see. It doesn't do what it's supposed to. You know, eyes are two. You're supposed to have two eyes, and they work together, and your vision focuses. And this eye just refuses to do it. It becomes a metaphor. Actually, in real life, many people have lazy eyes, and they're not very interesting. They just, you just see everything all fuzzy and broken up. And but I kept squinting and reminding myself, what do I see with that eye? And it is, as I say, like a Seurat painting. Everything is kind of in dots. And I thought, well, what does that mean? And that's how you construct a metaphor, or a metaphor finds you. What does it mean to be in dots? Things are broken apart. They're not coherent. They're vulnerable. The world is not as solid as we conceive it to be. And indeed, the world isn't as solid. And the thing about Brooklyn, where Audrey grows up, is that it is very solid. And the effort of everyone in Brooklyn in the 50s was to convince themselves and their children that it's all decent and steady and calm and secure, and don't worry, kids, just lie low, stay home, don't go anywhere, and you'll be okay. But, you know, the world is quite different, and she wanted to find out.
Well, that was a very suggestive metaphor, because I think that all of us have some way of growing up protected. And she starts to see essentially a different world, a second world, out of her bad eye, the world where chaos lives. And it's she's taken by her mother to a big man, one of the doctors. The mother knows the big man in medicine, and he comes to look at her eye in a manner that is immediately extremely sexual.
Yes, I guess you want me to tell what happens. Well, she goes to this big man, and they're not all really so big, they're just called that. the important thing about this doctor is that he's in Manhattan. That's the first important thing about him. Manhattan, to youngsters in Brooklyn in the 50s, was the exotic island. It's all you have to do is cross a bridge, you get in a subway and put in your 10 cents. And you're there in 30 minutes. But Manhattan is the exotic place. So she goes there expecting to find an adventure. And Manhattan still is an exotic island to me. I think I'll never get rid of that. The eye doctor, ironically, is the man who's supposed to give her a contact lens. It will not improve her vision, because that can't be done, but it will cosmetically improve her, make both eyes look the same, and make her eyes stop moving up and down. Ironically, this is not what he does. In other words, he's supposed to lead her back to convention and make her more marketable, as girls were kind of packaged and fixed so that, you know, they could marry somebody or somebody would marry them. However, what he does is quite different. He seduces her. But even as I say that, seduces her, it's not good. He starts out, he makes the first move, but she moves right back, and she responds rather outrageously for a girl her age. And there they are, having an affair, and this is a very delicate and ambiguous subject. But to me, it's less about a seduction or an exploitative relationship than it is about power. And when you look at this relationship between a doctor of, I think he's 37 or 38, and a girl of almost 16, you'd expect that the exploitation, you know, the doctor is the one exploiting the girl. And in a way, it is. But in truth, the way I write it, I think I've turned it around, just as I try to turn everything around in this book. Everything is topsy-turvy. He's the one who ends up really loving her, or loving her in the way when, you know, grown-up loves a kid, and maybe it's some odd way, but there is a love there. He cares about her. He sees her as a person. He wants to know her. He will miss her. She, on the other hand, uses him mercilessly and ruthlessly. She's a very tough, ruthless adolescent. She does not see him as a human being. She's the exploiter. So I turn that relationship from what might be something very offensive, I think. Maybe it is offensive. I don't know. To something other than what it seems. On the surface, it's one thing. Beneath, it's another thing, which is the general strategy of the book.
Well, it has a very shocking kind of doubleness, because his seduction begins as a penetration of the eye, opening her eye and putting the lens in and making sure that she can take it.
And that's the sexiest part.
Yeah, well, it's a very sexual section, and at the same time, hard to read. In the same time that it was hard for me to stand the idea of taking a contact lens. I think when you're reading about the eye, anywhere, there is an enormous mortal fear that the thing that you're using to read the words could, in fact, itself be violated. And then, you know, I was describing the book to a friend, actually a therapist friend, who I kind of came up to the climax of the book, which is quite disturbing, really. And I said, I don't want to tell you what happens after that. And he said, well, I know what happens after that. I said, well, what? I thought he'd have some special insight.
Maybe he read it.
He said, they no longer see eye to eye.
Oh. Right. Well, he tampers with her vision in many senses. It's such a wonderful metaphor, and I feel proud of it because I didn't invent it. You know, I was born with it. So it was just handed to me on a platter. And I'm just glad that I was able to use it.
Well, there's a very interesting parallel in a certain way to this novel. Did you happen to read the story, What It Was Like Seeing Chris?
Oh, Deborah Eisenberg?
Yeah.
Yes, yes, I did.
Because it's sort of interesting. There, the girl goes to Manhattan. She's seeing the eye doctor ostensibly, but she's actually seeing a boyfriend that she meets at the
right.
bar.
Oh, right. I forgot that there's an
and
eye doctor in there.
Finally, the metaphor, the metaphor becomes what it was like seeing Chris both clearly and seeing him morally as well. So I found myself reading this and thinking, well, this is very interesting. You know, it really is a theme. I myself was born cross-eyed, and so the themes of patches and lazy eye and all of that seems to me to be deeply, you know, significant. And once when I visited an optometrist, this may be worse than spending the time talking about Brooklyn, this bandit
well,
talking about optometrics. But he actually said to me, you know, those people who wear glasses do tend, with their narrow vision, to have the vision perfect for reading. It's the box vision of the man with the book. And I thought, well, yes, well, we're determined biologically to be authors.
Maybe it's right, yes.
I noticed, though, in terms of biological vision, you're often called or compared to an anthropologist.
That has happened. I've noticed that myself two or three times now. So what does that mean? I guess it's a way of observing. There are anthropologists, you know, who are a cool and objective at the same time that they are passionately involved. In fact, I think contemporary anthropologists tend to get more passionately involved with the communities and then go home and have to mix that with the objective handling of data. So in that sense, maybe I am. I'm certainly not cool toward my material.
Oh, no, but and yet on the first page, you talk about Brooklyn in the 50s as having a mythology as arbitrary and rooted as in the Trobriand Islands or in the or in certain Aztec cities.
Yes, Teotihuacan. I had just come back from a trip to Mexico. And I had a wonderful time and I visited this city. I think it was in Teotihuacan. There are many old cities. And I guess it was, you know how when you write, you use whatever is with you and on your mind. And I brought that in, and I had used the Trobriand Islands, in fact, in Disturbances in the Field. I've read some anthropology. And it's this looking on at what are our customs, after all, that we're only one tribe among many, and the ways we live are simply modes that have been developed. There's no absolutes. There are no absolutes that the absolutes are not ours. They don't belong to us.
Well, what strikes me as being, in many cases, a kind of theme of your fiction is the question of what equipment do we use to see in. You know, in Disturbances of the Field, the women first see the world or approach the world through their great books and philosophies courses. And I guess the books that I've read seem to approach gradually seeing with the naked eye, seeing unassisted by the equipment of culture or family or anything else. And here, too, the woman is left at the end, Audrey, with the obligation now to see for herself.
To use the vision that she's acquired. It's interesting that what you say about Disturbances in the Field is quite true, because there, unlike with Leaving Brooklyn, there I did have two or three major ideas at the beginning that guided me through the book. This one was more of a found book. And one of the themes was how in high school and college, if you have a decent education, you tend to, at least I tended to think that the books I was reading would help me get through life, that whatever Plato or Descartes or whoever said that these were truths that I should carry around with me and apply them when I got to a difficult moment. And I later discovered you cannot do that unless it becomes so embedded in you, but you can't do it from an intellectual standpoint. And I try to show in a rather playful way how the girls, originally they're girls and disturbances in the field, start out that way, and one by one, there are four of them, they have to move away from an intellectually based stance and toward a more, as you call it, naked vision.
You know, Lynn Sharon Schwartz is the author of Leaving Brooklyn, which has just been published by Houghton Mifflin. And I've noticed that the notion of subversive fiction, you call the book Melting Pot.
And other subversive stories, yes.
Right. That these subversions are both subversive of the form of stories as well as subversive politically. There's a sense, as you read this book, of a sudden inversion of the world where you're seeing something other than what you think is taking place. A girl calling home talks to her mother about what it's been like to study with her girlfriend when in fact she's just beginning to put clothing back on from a very explosive sexual meeting. But it's a formal subversiveness as well.
Very formal, yes.
Could you talk about that?
Yeah, people have asked me why I called The Melting Pot and other subversive stories by that name, because my writing is not, on the surface, revolutionary. In fact, some of it is very traditional, especially the stories. If you read them, you're reading an ordinary realistic story. But my hope and my tactic is that by the end, you'll find things have shifted a little bit. When you finish the story, you're a little unsettled. Things are not quite as they were when you began. And if you look through the story, it's quite calm and controlled on the surface. So what is it that makes you shift? Well, that's, I don't know what it is, but it's something that I'm aware of doing. In this book, what is subversive are all the things we've been discussing, that things are not what they seem. And all through my book, so, but more and more with each one, I think I've been getting bolder as I get older. Rhymes. I've been trying to nudge away at the accepted wisdom, which is so, it's not only dull, but it's so dangerous and holds people back so much.
I have been talking to Lynn Sharon Schwartz, the author of Leaving Brooklyn. The book came out this month from Houghton Mifflin. And in terms of the memory of adolescent experience, recollected at the point when the adult can see much more widely into that experience, it's an unforgettable book. It has a double vision, both of its adolescent heroine and of its narrator, and even contains almost a surprise ending that Audrey does not become, in fact, what she thinks she is on her way to being, an actress. We discover, in fact, that she is the author of these stories, someone condemned to betray the past by telling them. Thank you very much for being with me here, Lynn Sharon Schwartz.
Thank you, Mike.
Welcome back to Bookworm. We're here in the second portion of our show with Koki Iwamoto, the owner of Chatterton's Books in Las Feliz, Los Angeles. And as you know probably by now, we are interested in supporting all of the elements of the literary culture we have in Los Angeles, but our owners of independent bookstores deserve our special tribute. They really are idealists, as we are at KCRW, and it's our pleasure to extend affection and recognition to them. Koki opened Chatterton's bookstore, what year was that?
That was in 1972, September.
And so
it's been almost 17 years, I guess.
Okay, I have to ask that question again because you were off mic. You don't have to lean in, but you have to not move.
Okay.
Where do I start? Okay. But the beginning of the question will stand, right? You know, I spoke for a bit. Okay. Koki, when did you open Chatterton's bookstore?
I opened Chatterton's in 1972, September.
God, that's, what, 17 years that now that you've been...
It'll be 17 years this year.
...serving the community. I know, in fact, that you started out in a bookstore where I once worked. That was Papa Bach, right?
That's almost true. Prior to that, I had been working at the Free Press bookstores, the Kazoos. There was one in Pasadena, there was one in Westwood, and then the Fairfax store across the street from Cantor's. That was during high school, and after which, when I was going to UCLA, I was working at Papa Bach for, well, I would say about 5 years or so.
For many, many years, people would ask me, where did you get the name Papa Bach? And it took me 2 years of working there to realize that Papa Bach was their informal way of saying paperback. It was a bookstore located catty corner to the New Art Theater, and its parting was really very much mourned by many people, many of the readers of Los Angeles. But Chatterton's has managed to brave the catastrophes that saw Papa Bach under. What do you attribute the continued health of the bookstore to?
Well, we've had our ups and downs ourselves over the years. I would say 7 years ago, I opened a store in Pasadena and saw some hard times during that recessionary period we saw in the late 70s, early 80s, and had to subsequently close the store, pull back into the Vermont store again, and literally start from scratch all over again, particularly since we were going through at that time a major earthquake renovation project, which meant that... during a certain part of June of 1 year, the roof was entirely off of the store, and it happened to rain in Southern California in June at that, and we lost a great deal of stock. And
Now I know where they get a bookstore called Book Soup.
Right.
You know, I went to Chatterton's just the other night to see what was up, and it was a great pleasure and relief to come back into a bookstore that was clearly still an all-purpose, all-service literary bookstore. What are some of the things that a customer can find at Chatterton's that are not as easily found at other bookstores?
I think, aside from your university bookstores, we carry a lot in the way of university presses, which aren't normally seen in other bookstores, particularly chains.
I want to interrupt there to say when we talk about something coming from a university press, that once meant very erudite, but now with most of the major publishers, so-called, shucking their responsibility to publish first-rank poetry, translations of some of the great classics of European modern literature, we're finding from university presses books that are absolutely indispensable, and as a result, you know, the chain stores just don't take the risk. Some of the primary things that there are to read are to be found at stores like Chatterton's or Dutton's or Book Soup. It's very important that these bookstores be supported.
Thank you. I think you're right when you say that. But at the same time, they do publish very esoteric things. And the main problem, I suppose, with chains carrying university presses is that the paperbacks, for instance, are extraordinarily expensive, or can be. And when you start talking about a $20 or $25 paperback, it gets rather...
I remember, you know, when I worked at Papa Bach, customers becoming huffy about what was becoming of the price of paperbacks. How do you explain when people get upset about that?
Well, luckily, over the years, I think people have gotten used to the continuing rise of books, particularly paperbacks, so we get less of that kind of huffiness from our customers than we did before. Particularly with the people that are buying university presses, they've come to expect, unfortunately, come to expect paying considerably more for their books than they would have just an average trade quality paperback.
Well, you also have literary journals.
Yes.
And small newspapers and magazines, great minority literature sections, as well as literary criticism, gay literature, women's literature. How do you keep up in all these fields and know what is the most interesting new stuff? Because I'm always impressed. There are always surprises, even for me, at Chatterton's.
Well, I'm lucky to have a very good staff, people that have been with the store for, well, 17 years, one, and 15 years and 12 years and that sort of thing. And they're very much attuned to what our clientele or want or are interested in reading at any one time. And through their through that sort of contact, they're able to indicate to me or what should be ordered, what we should keep in stock, what sections are selling better than others. And I think that's the main thing. Our staff is very closely attuned to our customers.
Chatterton's is located at 1818 North Vermont in Les Feliz, and you're lucky to have a movie theater right next door
to
you. Is that used to be the saving grace of Papa Bach. What are other things that help a bookstore? If someone were looking to start up a bookstore in Los Angeles, a serious bookstore, what would you tell them to find in the area if they want to be relatively safe?
Well, I think a movie house, is particularly the kind of movie house that the Los Feliz has been over the years, it could be very extraordinarily helpful. Other kinds of things, nightlife, restaurants. We have Sarno's down the block from us. Coffee houses, that all helps. Parking helps. Being on a major thoroughfare also helps. There are any number of things that one could, consider, little things to that would be advantageous for a bookstore.
You know, as America has changed and bookstores have become, in some sense, marginalized, I noticed, even back then at Papa Bach, that bookstores had begun to collect an odd kind of clientele, a kind of street clientele, along with the regular readers. Has Chatterton's had that problem?
For some strange reason, lately we've had a share of that, and I'm not sure why or maybe some sort of vibration coming out of the bookstore that encourages people like that to come into the store. But
there is
that element.
It is interesting because sometimes I think with a very sad heart that some of the street people are the great readers and poets and literary lovers during the 60s who never found the path to put their lives on. And I think they come to bookstores because that's where they feel at home. And it's nice also to find, you know, a kind of gentleness in their treatment when I go into a bookstore.
Right. There may be some of that as well. I'm not sure, but it is certainly an interesting phenomenon.
Oh, yes. I think it is. One of the pleasures of Chatterton's is its clientele, and I will go. I told Cokie when we were talking on the phone that I'll go and follow interesting-looking book buyers around just to see what it is they're reading. You know, you want to start up a conversation with the right person. Have you, as an owner of the bookstore, made lifelong friends among your customers?
Oh, absolutely. Many, many friends to the bookstore and continue to make them to this day. As old friends come back and new customers come in, it's been truly a wonderful experience being in the store and meeting people and establishing friendships over the years.
We've been talking to Cokie Iwamoto of the Chatterton Bookstore, which is at 1818 North Vermont. Thank you for being with us, Cokie.
Thank you very much, Mike.
It's been nice to have you.
Real pleasure.
You've been listening to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. I'd like to thank Melinda Siegel, our associate producer, and Barb Carlson, our engineer.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.